Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Hi, this is Here and Now Anytime, where we give you a little news, a little something you weren't expecting, and always a fresh, in-depth perspective on current events, arts and culture, and stories that matter. Subscribe or follow to get all our episodes out every weekday. And if you like what you hear, tell a friend about us to help spread the word. Now here's the show.
The time has now come to suspend my campaign. I said I wanted Americans to have their voices heard. I have done that. I have no regrets.
Alas, poor Haley. We hardly knew ye. It's Wednesday, March 6th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, a feast for the ears. Kathy Gunst has recipes for snacks to serve at your Oscars watch party this weekend. And Robin sits down with Chef Eric Repair to talk about his life, his friendship with Anthony Bourdain, and his latest cookbook, Seafood Simple. Repair's love of food is deep and has some heavy connotations.
When we were eating, it was peace, and then we were starting the war again.
Well, food meant peace.
Yes.
Before the meal, though, a little political cocktail hour, or 8 minutes, as it were. Donald Trump is now the Republican Party's presumptive nominee for president. It's been a slow and inevitable death for the campaign of Nikki Haley, who bowed out of the race earlier today. But Haley did not endorse Trump, who won by huge margins in almost every state on Super Tuesday. Of course, she didn't endorse Biden either, who also won easily this week, everywhere except American Samoa. So where does the race go from here? We turned, as we often do, to NPR's own political sage, Ron Elving. He spoke to Robin Young.
So the night was pretty much as expected, both Trump and Biden dominating. But, you know, was there anything that surprised you after yesterday?
Not given the time frame of the last couple, 3 months, everything we've seen indicated that the Republican voters are taking all of Donald Trump's legal and financial problems as evidence that he is a martyr and they are rallying behind him. So given that, and given that no other candidate emerged who ever really seemed to be a real threat to Trump, obviously the Ron DeSantis campaign fell apart, and others who thought perhaps they would have a shot this time around if voters had doubts about Trump have also long fallen by the wayside. So all those men you saw Nikki Haley on stage with last year, they're all gone. Nikki Haley soldiered on, and she is still soldiering on after a fashion, withholding her endorsement. How much of a factor that will be, we'll have to see. But it's conceivable that it could be something of a factor. It didn't bother Donald Trump that much that back in 2016, Ted Cruz waited until September to endorse him. But on the other hand, it did contribute to a certain amount of churn and turmoil in the Republican Party. And we could see that again, given Trump's other problems.
Well, just talk briefly about that endorsement that did not happen. At one point today in her concession speech, very gracious, she said, "I've endorsed every Republican candidate." And I thought she was going to then say, to great fanfare, "And I'm now doing that again." And she didn't. Instead, she quoted Margaret Thatcher about, you know, don't follow the crowd, and didn't endorse. What did you make of that moment?
Well, she certainly did not do what everyone would have expected her to do with that lead-in about, "I've always endorsed the Republican candidate, so I'm not going to endorse this one." Whoa, that leaves a rather large question mark. Why not? Yeah. And of course, we're going to be asking that in the weeks and months ahead, and I'm sure that will be highly annoying to the presumptive nominee. Yeah. But Nikki Haley has established a point here, and there were other votes for other people during this campaign saying, we, the Republican Party, are not uniformly on board to be the cult, the personality cult of Donald Trump. Some of his supporters are perfectly fine with that. They have bought in entirely to his persecution complex, if you will, and they see every bad thing that happens to him as further confirmation of that. Mm. But Nikki Haley represents a different viewpoint within the Republican Party. It's notable that she won among college-educated voters in many primaries, and also notable that a certain number of people who might not have been all that excited about her also said, and particularly in suburbs, particularly women voters in the Republican primary, said that they weren't sure they were going to vote for Trump in the fall.
Yeah. More than 80,000 people in North Carolina and 45,000 in Minnesota voted uncommitted as part of a movement protesting Biden's support so far. I mean, his lack of calling for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza and his support of Israel in that way. Oh, boy, what is the president's challenge there?
It's a sizable fraction, but an important one, especially in Michigan, because this is a number of voters who, if they really did turn their backs on Biden and either vote for Trump in the fall, which seems unlikely, but stay home, which seems quite likely, that would be the difference, perhaps, in a very close election, which we anticipate, as it was in 2016 and 2020, very close, especially in Michigan. And so let's just say that on that particular issue, it could cost Biden Michigan, possibly some other states. Unlikely that it would be quite as effective as it is in that one state because it is such a closely divided state. At the same time, you are dealing here with one of the great difficult questions of all of history. The Middle East, the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians has thousands of years of history. And getting over that particular hump at this particular moment does not get done overnight. Nonetheless, if Biden could get even a temporary ceasefire, the talks, you know, sputter. Mm-hmm. But if he could get even a temporary ceasefire, I think everyone would welcome that in that region, and everyone would welcome that here in the United States. And perhaps some of the heat could come off of this, but there's no predicting what's going to happen in that part of the world.
I don't think I can remember a presidential election where polls showed that so many of the electorate was not happy with the candidates, you know? What's your thoughts on the mood of the electorate and what the candidates have to do?
Well, in 2016, Hillary Clinton was the least popular figure or the least approved figure in national terms ever in a presidential election, except for one other person, and that was Donald Trump. So we saw this in 2016. Some political types now call them the double haters, people who don't like either candidate and really don't like either candidate. And we have that again. It wasn't so true in 2020, but it is back with us. And people are going to feel, so perhaps they want to stay home or vote third party or vote for an independent candidate. All of those things essentially amount to either throwing away your vote or acting as a spoiler for one of the two candidates. Most theories are that the more people who vote third party, the more it helps Donald Trump. But that's yet to be proven. It's very discouraging also to see all these primaries coming in the next several months that mean nothing. And that's going to discourage people from coming out to vote. And that's not good for democracy either. We need a new nominating system in both parties. I think that's clear.
Mm. And just and you've got about half a minute here. What are you looking for just even in the next few days?
Well, we saw Mitch McConnell come out and endorse Donald Trump today. That's for probably personal reasons of his own, given that he has to continue as the Republican leader in the Senate. But how many other Republicans are going to be willing to say, I'm not on board yet? How many Republicans are going to say, look, we're loyal, we're good Republicans, we're going to vote for whoever the nominee is, even if we have to hold our nose?
Yeah. And also we have a State of the Union address from President Biden. Ron Elving.
That will be critical to Joe Biden's future as well.
Ron Elving, NPR senior editor and correspondent. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Coming up next, Robin speaks with the great chef Eric Repair, who has a new cookbook that draws on culinary expertise cultivated over a lifetime, but which is rooted in experiences he had as a child. Stick around.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares why accessibility is central to Betterment's mission.
The real innovation for Betterment was taking a set of tools that were used by the ultra wealthy and making them accessible to the average investor. And that includes tax strategies, that includes dollar cost averaging, These are all sort of tricks of the trade.
Learn more about automated investing technology at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares why Betterment believes cash can be a strategic choice.
There are times when the market is volatile, when customers are a little nervous about investing. We came to understand that there was an opportunity to introduce cash as part of an investing strategy and to give back yields to the customer.
Learn more about high-yield cash accounts at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance not guaranteed. Cash reserve offered through Betterment LLC and Betterment Securities. Betterment is not a bank.
Chef Eric Repair's New York restaurant Le Bernardin is one of the best, some say the best, in the world. It's held 3 Michelin stars, the top honor, since the prestigious French Guide came to New York in 2005, the same year Eric took over from the restaurant's beloved founders, Gilbert Lacoste and his sister McGee. Le Bernardin has consistently received 4 stars from the New York Times. How? Well, attention to detail. Chef told us that every night his entire cook staff gathers around a table on which sits a block of cheese. Because everyone's palate is different and always changing, they all taste a piece of the cheese and then collectively decide if it's too salty or not salty enough. And only then, having calibrated their individual taste buds to the reality of the cheese, do they go cook and season. And still, every plate must then come back past Chef Repair for a tiny taste. Some he sends back, although with kindness. We sat down at WBUR's sold-out City Space for a conversation that touched on cooking tips. His latest book is The Beautiful Seafood Simple. His faith, Buddhism. His loving friendship with the late Anthony Bourdain. But we started with, how did he get here? This will come as a shock to many, but you were born in France.
Yes. I don't have an accent, but I was born in France. Yeah.
Sadly, Dad died when you were 11. Stepdad, very abusive. But you also speak of a mom who cooked elegant meals. How is that in the you we meet today?
Oof. Well, I was very lucky. I had 2 grandmothers, one from Provence, one from Italy, cooking from their own culture. And then my mother was obsessed with fine dining. I would eat lunch and dinner with a different tablecloth, different china pattern, different wine on the table. And my mother would cook appetizer, main course, and dessert for lunch and dinner. And it would be different every lunch and dinner, every day of the week. And I thought every kid in the world was eating. I was like... I had the passion for eating and for being in a kitchen, even when times were difficult at home. My stepfather was not really a good friend of mine. But when we were eating lunch and dinner, it was peace. And it was very civilized until the end. And then we were starting the war again.
Well, food meant peace.
Yes.
And civility.
I strongly believe that.
You go to culinary boarding school at 15.
Yes.
Then work at one of the most storied restaurants in Paris, Le Tour d'Argent.
Yes.
Another Jamin with Chef Joël Robuchon. You went right to the top in Paris.
Yes. So I went at 15 to culinary school because I was a bad student. Instead of studying, I was reading cookbooks at night. The principal called me in office with my mom and said, look, the kid cannot go further. We have to find a vocational school. And I was like, yeah, culinary school. I'm going to culinary school, which I did.
Yeah.
And when I graduated, I grabbed the Michelin guide and I wrote a letter to the 18 three-star restaurant. And I said, yeah, I'm Eric Repair. I'm 17 years old. I just graduated. I want to come to your restaurant. Nobody answered. And then 2 months later, I received a letter from La Tour d'Argent in Paris. So I packed and started in La Tour d'Argent.
At 24, you come to the U.S. By the way, I adored my mom, but I had tuna casseroles. So I'm thinking of what I had growing up and what you had. Why did you come to the U.S.?
That's a good question. I was at Joël Robuchon, and he sent me to Washington, D.C.
Where you meet and work with the extraordinary Jean-Louis Paladin.
Yes. Suddenly I was with Jean-Louis, who was extremely creative, gave me the opportunity to basically free myself from the dictatorship of Joël Robuchon and just start to express myself. The community of chefs, yes, we compete, but it's a very friendly competition. When you sit down at a table and you share a meal with someone, suddenly something magical happens. That's the power of eating together, and especially if you are cooking together, it's even more powerful.
Yeah. Well, you took from all the different chefs you worked with, and then, of course, in 1991, you were working with Chef Gilbert Lecoz.
Yes.
Le Bernardin. So sad. He died unexpectedly at 49. You're 29, and it's one of the best restaurants in the world, and 2 years later, you're the co-owner. 31. Terrified?
No. I mean... Well, first of all, when Gilbert Lecoz passed away, it was very difficult emotionally for me because he was a mentor, he was a dear friend, we were very close, and he gave me a lot of freedom to express myself. So when he passed away, it was not too much of a big change, except that I missed him tremendously. Mm-hmm. And then supposedly was a buzz in town that I was too young, I was going to lose the stars, I was going to not maintain the quality. I really didn't care. How can I make the food better today than yesterday, which is the same today actually? How can I make it better than yesterday? How can dinner be better than lunch? How can lunch tomorrow can be better than dinner, and so on? It's only what I was thinking about.
Yeah. Now, you are vocal about your disapproval of abusive chefs.
For
but
sure.
But there was a time when you acted through anger.
So when I grew up in the 80s in a kitchen, the chef was glorified as a mini dictator. And abuse was glorified. We were being verbally abused, physically abused. They were punching us in the shoulders, kicking our butt. Sometimes taking us in the coolers, the big fridge, and beating us. We were insulted, never a compliment. The idea was to break them and then rebuild them as champions. And it was the most stupid idea that I ever heard. I mean, we lost so much talent. But anyway, I was conditioned. So when I had my first position of authority in a kitchen, what did I do? I emulate my mentors. And in my life, I was miserable. And then the team was leaving. The ones that were staying with me were miserable. And then one night, I had this duh wake up kind of moment. And I
Is
said,
that I'm French?
I'm No. And I said, you know, I'm wrong. We have to change. So I came back the day after and I said, hey guys, we're changing everything. I'm so sorry. I apologize. But I had trained sous chefs for years to be abusive. Yeah. And then it took me months to retrain them because they were like, you nuts. Yesterday you tell us to be like this, now you change your mind. But I have to say, a cook who's shaking like this will never do a better job than a cook that's joyful. If it goes into the food, I guarantee you that the food will be better when you put love instead of fear. But I want to finish.
Do everything.
I want to finish because I have something to say. And then I see on television some programs now with some chefs that are promoting verbal abuse, stupid attitude. I'm not going to say, well, I'm going to say his name.
I was.
Right? I mean, Gordon Ramsay. Yeah. I mean, what is he doing? What is the production company behind him doing? What is the TV network supporting that? What are they doing? It's not the right thing to do. And each time I have an opportunity, I give it to Gordon.
I wondered how much you're becoming a Buddhist impacted this.
It's a philosophy that really speaks to me. Today, I really try to find a secular way to share with my team what I have learned.
And I am wondering if it helped you in the terrible time, we're just going to touch on it, Anthony Bourdain.
Yes. We were very close. We even had a show called Good and Evil. We went to 35 cities in the US, and even Las Vegas. I saw my name on a marquee. I was like, oh my God, I made it with Tony. We will come on the stage and start to roast each other first. So it was brutal. And that friendship lasted until the very end.
The very end. I mean, you were there at the end, and you and the crew have vowed not to talk about it. And so
yes.
We're going to honor that. I just, as you moved on, you know, what did you take from him, and how did you turn that corner, this deep friendship? You know, that's tough.
Anthony and I were very different. And I think different, but I have the same values about doing the right thing. He will go in Vietnam, in Libya, in Congo, will be in the middle of the rainforest and be with someone with no education and nothing to offer except a little bit of food, sometimes not the freshest food. And by respect, he will eat everything that was given to him. Anthony would have hate for me to say love and compassion, and he was like, not about that, but he was practicing love and compassion, extremely respectful of other people, of their culture, of everything that was offered to him from the people he was interacting with, which is basically love and compassion.
Eric Repair speaking with Robin Young. We've got a recipe from the book, Seafood Simple, halibut with warm herb vinaigrette, at our website, hereandnow.org. And for your next course, Robin and Lisa Mullins get some recipes for snacks you can serve to complement your Oscars viewing party. Even if the ceremony is a flop, your spread can be the star. That's after the break.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com. This message comes from NPR sponsor E-Trade from Morgan Stanley. Take control of your financial future with E-Trade. No matter what kind of investor you are, their tools and resources can help you be ready for what's next. Now, when you open an account, you can get up to $1,000 with a qualifying deposit. Terms apply. Learn more at etrade.com/NPR. Investing involves risks. Morgan Stanley Smith Barney LLC. Member SIPC. E-Trade is a business of Morgan Stanley. This message comes from NPR sponsor, Lisa. Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between Lisa and West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is expertly crafted from natural latex, natural wool, and certified safe foams to elevate your sleep sanctuary and support a greener tomorrow. Plus, every purchase helps fuel Lisa's work with shelters and those in need. Visit Lisa.com to learn more. That's LEESA.com.
The Academy Awards are this Sunday night. Mm-hmm. Robin Young, you know that. Mm-hmm. And our next guest can help with one of the most important questions.
Oppenheimer versus Barbie?
No, snacks.
Oh,
our president
of course.
Chef Kathy
yes.
Gunst is here. Hi, Kathy.
Hello to both of you.
So, Kathy, we understand you are a longtime fan of Oscar.
It's a bit embarrassing and yet true.
Why?
I mean, with all happening in the world right now, it seems so irrelevant. And yet, I think we need it. I mean, when I was a little kid, it was a big thing. My mother said, you can stay up till 8. You can stay up till 9. Until finally I was old enough to watch the whole thing. The dresses, the jewelry, the glitz, the glam.
And the snacks. And the snacks.
The snacks are key.
So get us
started.
So we
thought we'd have fun.
Yeah.
Yes.
You've come up with snacks inspired by some of the nominees, starting with May, December. That's up for an Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay.
Correct.
It's loosely based on the Truce, Mary Kay Letourneau scandal. So remind us of, you know, just a bit of the film and your thinking about the snack, the matching snack. This is going to be a tough one, I would think.
Yeah, it's a very dark movie, but the opening scene shows us Gracie Atherton Yu, played by the brilliant Julianne Moore, and she's arranging dozens of hot dogs on the grill for a 4th of July picnic party. And there are just so many, and her line is, "I don't think we have enough hot dogs." So I thought that I would do a little riff on that and do pigs in a blanket, and I used hot Italian sausage. You could use sweet or chorizo, and I wrap them in frozen puff pastry, so you don't have to bake anything or make pastry. You rub the pastry with a little Dijon mustard. You put a little piece of the sausage in. You roll it up tightly to look like a baby croissant, and you put a little egg white on it and some sesame seeds. You pop it in the oven, serve it with some mustard, and you are good to go. And that is Honoring May December.
Which is a film about a much older woman who began her affair with a 13-year-old and then married him and had a long marriage. So,
exactly.
Okay.
Okay, so now from the hors d'oeuvres to the dessert, which is exactly the right order. You have an homage to the Barbie movie, which is up for eight Oscar nominations, including Best Picture. No surprise, they're pink desserts.
Well, Barbie is the land of pink fluff, and pink is Barbie's favorite color. So I made meringue cookies, and I colored them with freeze-dried strawberry powder, which is actually fairly easy to get. We give you a mail-order source. You could use food coloring as well, but you whip up egg whites to make these meringue cookies. You bake them till they're crisp and dry, and then you sandwich two together with whipped cream with a little vanilla, and then again, food dye or strawberry powder, and they look like they came off the set of Barbie. And let's remember, Barbie doesn't really eat, so that means there's no calories in these cookies.
Except when she starts to turn human or something, and then she pours milk on her face and stuff. But just remind people, meringue, it's such a, feels like a high-end thing, but it's so easy.
All it is whipped egg whites, and you throw in some sugar a tablespoon at a time, and you let it turn into like stiff, huge clouds. And then once it turns pink, you are in Barbie land. I mean, what does he call it? The mojo, mojo dream house.
This is
perfect mojo dream house food.
Finally, a recipe for Portuguese tarts, which celebrates the Best Picture nominee Poor Things, which stars Emma Stone, also up for an Oscar. Film with 11 nominations. She plays kind of a Frankenstein, you know, woman. She has to eat 60 Portuguese tarts.
Well, I did read that. Yeah, I read that she had to eat 60 of these Portuguese egg tarts, which are quite rich, flaky, eggy. They're delicious. And she was quoted as saying that eating the tarts was, quote, more challenging than the nudity. Okay, but you might only want to eat one or two of these. Again, I used frozen puff pastry as a time saver. It's not the traditional Portuguese way, but it works, and it's delicious, and you make a very simple custard with milk and sugar and cinnamon and egg yolks, and you bake them, and they're amazing when they're warm, but they will hold up for several hours, and this would be a great way to honor the very creative and quirky movie Poor Things.
Well, you have very creative ways of honoring all of the movies. I know you're not a film critic, but do you have any predictions for the films you're pulling for, maybe based on your favorite recipe that would go along with each film?
I wouldn't call them predictions. My wish is that Barbie gets some love on Sunday night. This is a movie to me that could have been about nothing, but it really became a film about women and the patriarchy and so much more. And I actually think it's brilliant. I also am a swimmer. I loved NIAID. I thought Annette Bening and Jodie Foster were incredible. I will be watching. I will not be wearing a gown, but I will be serving pink meringue cookies, pigs in a blanket, and Portuguese custard tarts.
We're going
with
to your
no
house.
Nude scenes, Kathy.
Well, we'll see.
Depending on how the night goes.
Okay. We've been talking Oscar Nibbles with Here Now resident chef Kathy Gunst. We'll have all of those terrific recipes at hereandnow.org. The meringues are gorgeous. Kathy, thanks as always.
Thank you so much.
Well, they're playing me off. That's the music. Means we gotta go. Here and Now Anytime comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Koyani Saxena, Karen Miller-Medson, and Emiko Tamagawa. Today's editors were Todd Munt, Peter O'Dowd, Micaela Rodriguez, and Kat Welch. Technical direction by Mike Moschetto, Caleb Green, and Michaela Varela. Mike also wrote our theme music, along with Max Liebman and me, Chris Bentley. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin, and the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening and subscribing to or following this podcast. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Oracle Cloud Infrastructure. AI may be the most important new computer technology ever, but AI needs a lot of processing speed, and that gets expensive fast. Upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure. OCI is the single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. Do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic. Take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor, the Capital One Venture X Card. Earn unlimited 2x miles on everything you buy. Plus, get access to a $300 annual credit for bookings through Capital One Travel. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
Okay, close your eyes for a second. Now imagine you're on your dream vacation. No work calls to answer, no text messages to respond to, just your suitcase and an opportunity.
The opportunity to just take yourself out of your routine and travel deeper.
How to actually take that dream trip. That's on the Life Kit podcast from NPR.